Back in the day when we started, like, we were sharing beds, like, alternatingly. So David and I, like, for the first 9 months of our company, we did not only share a room, we literally slept in the same bed. Just because we were, like, extremely broke, and San Francisco is not the cheapest place in the world, right? So, like, we did the full-on, like, early-stage founder ramen diet. So far that, like, I sometimes couldn't pay for food, and Costa had to lend me money. But then, like, after we raised some funding, we noticed that maybe we shouldn't pay each other only, like, $500 of salary a month. Maybe we should increase it a little bit. Early days were rough in that instant.
If you really want to get close with your co-founder, share a bed with them.
Hi, everyone. How are we all doing? Great?
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of Seed Stories. I'm super thrilled to have the entire squad from Blair here today. Thank you for joining, guys.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm Mike. Hey, everyone. I'm the CEO. I'm usually in charge of external stakeholders that are not our actual clients and users, which means, in our case, equity investors and then also debt investors since we're fintech. And I also deal with press and hiring. David, what about you?
I focus on operations, so pretty much anything on the day-to-day business side is on my end, customer support, sales, growth. I try to be the bridge a little bit between the product and the business team. They don't always speak the same languages, and I try to translate a little bit. I used to be our head designer as well. That's like my little passion of mine, but don't really find time to do that. And we have people that are much better at designing in the team now. But sometimes I get to design a couple of decks, which is great. And yeah, that's me, Costa.
Last but not least, Constantine, I'm focusing on product and tech, being one of the powers that David has to mediate between sometimes.
I love that. I always like to start with, and we'll get into what Blair is, because it's super exciting what you're working on. I always like to start with people's background. So Mike, let's kick it off with you, and would love to kind of hear how you got into technology and startup.
Yeah, it was kind of a detour, honestly. I, like, all of us grew up in Germany, in different parts of Germany, which is always fun because we can use the regional stereotypes to make fun of each other. But, like, I grew up, like, not really focusing on tech too much, and then got into gaming fairly early on. That was my first, like, venture into, hey, technology can do really cool things. And then decided to not study computer science, but study business, actually, because in Germany, studying computer science has a bit of a different reputation than it has in the US. And I think in the US, it has a much better one. And I actually like that a lot about the US. Then did, like, lots and lots of different internships. Interned at a startup in Silicon Valley after my second semester, which was a lot of fun because I literally cold LinkedIn message like 400 people until someone took me as an intern, because it wasn't that easy as a random German dude. And then afterwards, like, interned at Uber, worked at Stripe for a bit, did a couple of different things, and I learned very different things at the two companies, but both have definitely shaped my path. And then I think the core memory I have is during my internship in Silicon Valley, I still thought that, I don't know, maybe I'm doing an MBA or something like that, but someone just looked me straight in the eye and he just sold his startup to Google wearing, like, flip-flops and, like, some other, like, random stuff I didn't think, like, serious people would be wearing. And he looked at me and was like, Mike, if you think that you can outperform the market, it doesn't make sense to do anything else than just building your own business, because the market will always reward good stuff. Bad stuff, you just won't succeed. So you never should be employed anywhere if you think that you can outperform other people. And since I'm very competitive, that was the start to thinking about being a founder.
That's a phenomenal story and a great call to action and mentorship from a guy in flip-flops. So word to the wise listeners, just because they might look like a homeless person, you might still want to take their advice. David, how about you? How did you get into the world of startups and technology?
I got in it really early and pretty much by accident. I finished high school with 17, which is relatively early, and I didn't know what to do after. And then I randomly got a job at a startup. I was their first intern, and I did sales for them. And the founders at that time was a 3-4 person company, and they were still living with their parents. And I learned about cold outreach and cold sales in the kitchen of their parents, eating pizza, doing nothing but cold calling for 10 hours a day. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And that probably within my first job, there was already the last nail in the coffin of ever doing a corporate job in my life. So I was instantly hooked, to be honest. Not that I planned to do startups, but I just fell into it and absolutely loved it. During college, I have a business background. I met Constantine and usually at our school, most people do investment banking, M&A, private equity, things like that, consulting. But we were really into tech, and we organized one of the largest student-organized congresses on entrepreneurship and startups. And that's where I think we both learned about how important and how much leverage network has and getting to know people. Ever since we've been pretty much working together on different kind of side projects, I'd rather spend time on spinning up a little project rather than going to classes and learning about the more traditional side of things of business and rather look into what's happening in the world, what tech is enabling everyone to do. And yeah, that's pretty much how I got into it.
The downfall of universities and colleges is that people would rather just spend time tooling away on projects on the side rather than going to class.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Constant?
For me, it was somewhat similar. The first kind of hunch into that direction was through my father, who was not doing tech or startups, but had his own business since he was, 20 or so. Very old school, old-fashioned, kind of like B2B retail. So I was brought up always having like this entrepreneurial father figure, I guess, which I aspire to go down that same path. So the logical step was to study business, although I also was very interested in coding, self-taught to just earn some money next to school, just web dev stuff. But thought, let's study business. It's a safe bet for entrepreneurship in all kinds of ways. As David mentioned, we met each other there at the conference. And then during the time at business school, I noticed two things. A, that I was still really keen on wanting to know more about technology and just programming. And it was just bringing me joy, which the lectures not necessarily
not so
were,
much.
At least to the same degree. And the second thing I noticed is that all the other business guys that had some kind of entrepreneurial aspirations, they were all looking for tech co-founders, they were really rallying to get someone that they could found a business with. And so I thought, hey, why am I not going to be that person? Instead of trying to convince a tech co-founder to found a business, I'd rather be that person. And that's when I enrolled for computer science at Code University in Berlin. There I got the chance to spend some time in the Valley at another coding school called K12 or 42. And that was kind of for me the final nail in the coffin of committing to startups. And I loved the atmosphere, loved the vibe, loved the people. And that's kind of how it was for me.
Awesome. And that kind of leads me to this wonderful co-founding story. How did you three get together and decide that you knew you wanted to start a startup together? What was that?
That
moment.
That was actually like, I think it's a good story. So basically David and I, we met during our exchange semester in Los Angeles, where we're mostly just having fun and enjoying the fact that our classes didn't count. And then also enjoying the fact that the U.S. undergraduate system isn't necessarily the most difficult if you had studied in like Europe before. So we had a really good time, and we were like becoming really good friends very quickly, noticing that both of us were interested in startups. And we knew that we had someone that could sell really well. We knew that we had someone that could do like complex like structures, like all of the business operation things really well. And David could design, like, but none of us was like really good at just building things on our own. Like both of us like are a bit self-taught, but we're definitely not like a full, like we're maybe like a tenth of like a real software engineer potentially. And we are probably like a hundredth of Costa, which actually brings me to how he got on board. And 100 is probably already like, we're giving us too much credit. But like the funny thing was that David and I knew we wanted to build a business, and we always said that when we are founding a business, we need someone like Costa on our team. So he was our benchmark because Costa is one of the few engineers who I know who's just like a real, like, brilliant mind. And he's always underselling himself, so I have to do it for him. Like, he, like, when we were at YC, he was teaching other, like, really good engineers who worked at Google for like 6 years, some random stuff. And so we use him as a benchmark because he's like just a really good engineer. But then he's also very capable in understanding everything that's happening on the business side, which is very unfair if you talk to him because you have almost no leverage. But he is just combining that, like,
by the way,
extremely
I love this.
Well.
I love this is like founder therapy that's happening right now. It's just amazing.
And yes, yeah, so basically we just, at some point, like David and I were like, we are getting into this accelerator for immigrant founders, which is where we met you actually right down the line. And we were like, well, like we
this
need
is
a CTO.
The XX program.
Exactly. Yeah. XX program. Yeah. And then we thought, like, kind of obvious, but also like in hindsight, like, not, why don't we just ask Costa if we always use him as a benchmark? So we told him, okay, Costa, we have this business idea. We got into this accelerator. We're flying to San Francisco in like 5 days, like next week. Do you want to join us? And then he, like, it took him like half a day. And then he said, well, I'm dropping out of college, officially pausing college. But we knew, like, he will never go back. And then he joined us in our team. And then since then, it has been a very interesting journey, but we are lucky because we can work with people we just like and adore, and we can do that every single day.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that always impressed me about you guys was the co-founder chemistry. It seems like there's always an open book, the sharing the ups and the downs, and there's a level of camaraderie and friendship that is you don't always see in co-founding teams, and that history that you have together. And ability to make fun of each other, most importantly.
that's key.
Fast forwarding a little bit, what was the kernel of the idea that got you to wanting to start Blair?
What we try to achieve with Blair is, in general, to make education more accessible and affordable. And if you go a level above that, make the younger generation more financially independent. And Mike and I just had the experience to see firsthand how expensive education in the United States is, and B, how difficult it is to find financial solutions. And it was the scenario that we knew a perfect solution for all of this from Germany, where the problem A is not as big because education is just much cheaper, but we all went to private schools that are a little bit more expensive. And ISAs, maybe for everyone who doesn't know, we finance students' education, no upfront cost for the student at all. And once they graduate and get a job and make at least a specific threshold of income, only in that scenario they're required to repay a fixed percentage of their income. And the idea is that people who are taking out an ISA are not forced by debt to make career decisions, life decisions. So we say, hey, when you're in a good financial spot and earning money, you repay us. If you ever get fired, sick, you have to take care of someone and you leave the job, payments will stop. That's the general idea. And it's much easier to get it because we don't require a cosigner or credit score. So we were thinking, hey, there is this huge problem in the States. Usually you always have to do a lot of research to figure out if there is actually a problem. We were very fortunate to not do the research. Yeah. Exactly. So pretty crystal clear problem that we were trying to solve. And we were thinking, hey, we have firsthand experience of something that not a lot of people in the US are actually aware of. I think at the time that we started, Lambda School introduced the whole thing a little bit with ISAs, but it wasn't really popular back then in 2019 when we started it. And it's still relatively small compared to how many private loans are issued each day. But that was the whole idea, fixing the US problem with something that we knew firsthand from Europe.
I think what's great about this is it speaks directly to the Paul Graham essay, Schlepp Blindness, is there's problems in plain sight that most engineers or hackers or even business people don't want to solve because they're a huge schlep, which is a Yiddish word for like a heavy lift. And so like some of these things are very manual to solve these problems, but technology can help speed up, and automate some of those things. So how did you start? What was day one look? What did it look like? And how did you sort of bootstrap, financially?
Yeah, that was an interesting time in the very early days. So we got into this accelerator and we just had this idea, right? Nothing existed. We had like some fundamental understanding of the idea, but we didn't have a website. We didn't have anything, basically. So we needed to come up with lots of different things very quickly, mostly because we didn't want to like disappoint the people at XX. And then also we are very competitive, right? So we want to outcompete in a friendly way everyone else who's in the accelerator. So like first day, honestly, wasn't even focused that much on the business, but just about how do we actually get to San Francisco, because we were living in Berlin back in the day. And then like trying to like navigate all like flights and like travel situation and everything else. And then very shortly afterwards, the main thing that we were focusing on was talking to as many students as possible and getting their perspective on the problem and then also potentially our solution. And then we did the same with potential investors, because back in the day, what we were doing is financing college students directly through income share agreements. So the idea was that students could sign up on our website and get funding in return for signing a contract that said, if I earn more than a certain threshold, I will pay you a percentage of that for a certain number of years. So we're just randomly going to college campuses and like talking to college students. And that was always very interesting, because we were just running around campus and like approaching students. And some of us were more nervous, mostly like me, because I don't like randomly talking to strangers, at least in this instance. David didn't have a problem at all. And then Costa thought at first that he'd had a problem, but then he like really got into it as well. So it was interesting times. We had very good conversations and just really quickly noticed that there was an actual problem. So there wasn't day one, but like maybe the first like 25 days.
First couple of weeks. Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of something that Parker from Rippling said that people often misunderstand about startups, which is like you can see sort of the glossy headlines of like early stage companies, and then maybe you fantasize about what it's like to start a company in the very early days. But he was like, most of the time you're just like doing a little bit of work and then sitting in your boxer shorts and like wondering what to do next on a couch. And yeah. like your first day or week or month was like, we got to get a flight and like call some students, I guess, and like maybe figure out what I'm going to code, but I'm not even coding yet. So like,
yeah. And we were also super broke. Like back in the day when we started, like we were sharing beds like alternatingly. So David and I, like for the first 9 months of our company, we did not only share a room, we literally slept in the same bed just because we were like extremely broke, and San Francisco is not the cheapest place in the world, right? So like we did the full on like early stage founder ramen diet so far that like I sometimes couldn't pay for food and Costa had to lend me money. But then like after we raised some funding, we noticed that maybe we shouldn't pay each other only like $500 of salary a month. Maybe we should increase it a little bit. Early days were rough in that instance.
If you really want to get close with your co-founder, share a bed with them.
That's exactly what you, I think in hindsight, the sharing a bed thing was like very stupid. I mean, it was great, right? But we were really good friends even back then, but it caused some tension that we usually don't have, just because obviously, right? Sharing a bed is not the easiest thing in the world. But yeah, I think it's a very good story. And then our living room, like we all lived in one apartment. Our living room was the office. I shared a bed with David. Costa shared a bed with our first engineer, who's a good friend of his. And then every day we just get up, sit in the living room and just start working. And then every now and then we would just order food. And then at some point we'd go to bed again. That was the like first couple of months.
Awesome. I want to move next to like what happened at the end of the XX program, and then you eventually ended up applying to YC. So I do want to get your experience in demo days. That's for sure. So maybe talk to me a little bit about that that period of time.
I guess YC always was kind of a dream of ours, right? So we were watching Paul Graham and all the others and the. Even the partners that were still partners when we were there then. So I guess that was like the ultimate dream. And XX, I guess in retrospect, a stepping stone to get there. After XX, it was clear that it was the direction that we wanted to head in. But we were just too early, all right? Or that's what we thought, at least. We did two things, and the first thing is continue building the product. That was also the phase that we then started coding stuff. It was still pretty much a smoke test with nothing behind it. So we had to disappoint the first students that went through our application flow. And then at the end, when they thought they would get the money, we would just
really
display like a waiting list.
Yeah, I guess you know what they, you found out what they didn't like, and that was your product.
Exactly. And so then at the point when we thought we were ready, we just started doing lots and lots of mock interviews, started preparing, writing the application.
Who was your YC interview with? Do you remember?
Tim Brady, Kevin Hale.
It was four people.
Blacked out. It seems like you blacked out a little bit.
Oh, yeah, Stephanie.
I think it was Stephanie.
It's all a blur now.
Stephanie. PTSD. Got it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. The time after the interview, like, David and I were so disappointed with ourselves and had a really bad feeling. And I think most of it centered around the fact that we had like this one key thing that we thought would be like a great thing to say in the interview, and we didn't mention it. And like, we were really like, we thought we are out. And then Costa, he was super positive. He was like, well, guys, it wasn't that bad. It was really good. Like, the flow was nice. They asked good questions. And then, like, we were in this restaurant very close to the sea and, like, waiting for the call. And then I got a call on my phone, but it was, like, a random robocall from, like, auto warranty. And I was very close to just throwing my phone into the sea. And then I got, like, a second call at some point. And I thought, okay, please don't be a robocall. My heart wouldn't take another robocall. But then it was Tim Brady telling us, guys, you're in. And we still have a very nice video of me on the phone with Tim and like Costa filming me. And I couldn't talk anymore because I was so excited. I was like crying a little. That's like, sometimes we just watch that whenever we're sad.
For inspiration, and yeah.
One little anecdote. We did like 20 or 30 mock-up interviews. And actually our last one before the interview was with you. And I will never forget that we visited you in your SF office. And you did something that I currently do when I do YC mocks. You were very hard within the interview itself, but after that, you hyped us up as we were on our way to building the next Stripe. And that was such a nice confidence boost. And I think like having the right mindset for the interview is absolutely crucial. Like, you will never 100% play through it, and you don't control how it will go, right? You can definitely prep it. And I recommend everyone practice. But I always try to cheer everyone up, no matter how good the mock-up interview was or not. Maybe we're shitty as well, but I will never forget that.
I think what always happens with early stage or first time founders is they get nervous and clammed up a little bit. But if you're not excited about your company, nobody is going to be. And so like, you have to come out like of that shell a little bit and be like, I have flown across the planet. I'm sleeping in my bed with my co-founder. I've changed my entire life for this idea that I think is going to solve a massive problem in society. And here's why I'm really excited about it. Now, you don't want to like come off as, you know, artificial in any way, shape or form.
Yeah.
But you all had really good energy. And most founders who are working on a problem they care deeply about have really good energy. They just forget, like, this is not a job interview where you're supposed to be like, you know, very like prim and proper. Like, you're supposed to be really excited.
That's probably the biggest thing that like I've done for Blair in my life. I was just so hyped during the interview.
The hype man.
Yeah, the hype I can always bring. I think that's probably my biggest strength if we list them.
Yeah, no, this job of a CEO is like, keep the lights on and be a hype man or hype woman. Want to start getting into this the seed round that you raised. What was the traction that you were starting to get that A, made you think it was the right time to raise the next round, or B, made you feel like some of the mechanics of the business were working?
Just for reference for everyone who's listening, we raised a little bit of money before YC, like 200K. Then we raised roughly $1 million, like around demo day. We weren't like quite ready for like a full-on bigger round because of like regulatory things, like feedback cycles were a bit longer in our case. And then last year in February, like February 2021, we raised a big debt facility, and then we thought we were ready. And I'll try to explain it a little bit. So basically, because of COVID, beginning of 2020, like we had to reshift our full business model, like from direct to consumer to more like a B2B infrastructure play. So what we're doing now is we built the foundation of outcome-based financing, and we automate like most parts of the process. But basically what we want to be is the operating system for outcome-based financing. So we had to rebuild the product over the summer of 2020. And then we were getting our first like couple of test customers on board during the end of the year. And then in the meantime, I was trying to be out there and raising debt capital that we could use for an additional product on top of our tech product, where we could finance the schools that we would be working with, because now we wouldn't be only going directly to the students. We would go through the schools and then finance their students, or we
would...
It was an
end-to-end solution, really.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we had this like tech product. So I was out there like raising debt. And then we had three things actually that were happening at the same time. One, our product took the shape that was actually a usable product that solved the need of these schools that we were targeting. So that was basically like Costa's part. Then secondly, we're actually getting some users on board. That was what David did. Like he got schools on board. He made sure that they got onboarded and that like we get their students on board. And then lastly, we had the big debt round that we closed that would give us some firepower for our additional Blair Capital product. So we had these three things almost happen at the same time. And we thought like, first of all, now is the right time to raise. And then secondly, right, we also didn't have like that much runway left. And we don't want to be the kind of founders who like have a month left and then can't sleep every night when they fundraise. So we like to be like a bit more conservative and basically calm our own nerves a little bit. But yeah, then we thought, okay, these three things culminated and we are in a good position now to show we have the foundation, we have the promise. It's a really big problem. So let's go out there and talk to investors so that we can get to the next level.
Awesome. What was your next step? Did you start with a deck? Did you start with a list of people? You know, you guys are one of the most organized startups I've ever invested in. So walk through for the listeners and the audience, like what your process looked like.
Yeah, it's always great to hear that because we hear that a lot, but we always feel as if there's so much chaos around us. So I don't know how other people are doing it. But so basically, as you say, we like to like optimize processes and use benchmarks. So first of all, the very first thing I did was read every good piece of content I can and talk to other founders who have raised like good rounds before, what they were doing, and then distill all of that in our own optimized process. And how that looked like was the first thing we wanted to do is build a long list of potential investors that we wanted to talk to, both angel investors, but then also primarily funds who could lead our seed round. Because the difference from raising saves, which we had done before, and raising a price round, is that for a price round, you usually need your lead investor first, and you can't raise on a sequential basis. So like getting the lead means you get the round done, almost like in 99% of the cases. But with saves, it's more of a continuous thing. So we compiled this whole long list of investors that were like interested in our vertical and roughly the size of the round that we wanted to raise. And then in parallel, because you can do two things at once in this instance, is we prepared the storyline. So before we actually went into the deck, we thought about what story do we actually want to tell? Where do we start? Where do we want to end up? And then we try to fit the things in the middle. And then only when we had this, then we started with a deck and the additional fundraising materials. And then we had a long list of investors. We had a deck, we had an FAQ, and then I started practicing the pitch. That was everything like up to the actual pitching.
How much did you lean on your co-founders during this process? I mean, some CEOs or leadership teams, like they're like, you guys keep working on business and product. I'm going to just take this and run with it. Some are like, please, like, I need your help on this, or come to meetings. What was your style?
Yeah, so I think our style is a mix of those two styles. Like, I completely own the process. It's basically my job to get it done. But I can get resources from the others if I need them. So,
right,
like, it was my job to, like, craft the storyline and, like, get ideas and, like, move things around. But then I was sparring with David a lot, or depending on the, like, content itself, also with Costa. But the main thing was I had to get the fundraise done, and Costa and David needed to like keep the business running, as you said, right? And then there were some specific things where I had a lot of help, mainly the deck. So like David and Costa both can design. I'm mostly like good at conveying information, but not necessarily at visualizing it. So like that's where like a big step where I didn't do that much of the work. And then in terms of the actual pitching, it was always me and not like the team. Like sometimes, like for very like specific conversations, I looped in either David or Costa, but mostly it was just me because we felt that it's usually more natural, especially if it's only one person on the other side. So it could just be like a free flowing conversation. And then whenever they wanted to dive really deep into the tech side, I would loop in Costa, or if they wanted to speak specifically about some details on the customer side, I would loop in David. But mostly it was like me doing the fundraising, and I would just literally sell what David and Costa were building the whole time. So they were actually doing the work and I was just trying to sell it to other people. So that's how I usually look at it.
Well said. Let's put some facts and figures around the process. Like, how long did it take you? How many meetings roughly would you say you had? How were you feeling during that time?
It was a constant roller coaster. So like, I think I'm generally like a more confident person, like at least when it comes to like these business types of things. So I was very excited about going out. I just had like raised $100 million in debt, which I still don't know how we did that, but like we were very confident going in, but fundraising is almost always rough. So like the first 2 weeks, like I usually had like at least 5 calls a day. So like the first, like out of the first 50 meetings, 40 were just straight no's, and then like the rest were like maybes or something like that. So nothing that you can count on. So like for 2 days, I was really depressed. I was like, yeah, feeling as if I'm letting the company down and everyone did all the work.
You start off with all the no's, right? That's what a lot of founders don't realize, is like the no's happen at the beginning. So you are showing people your baby. They're telling you it's ugly. And now you have to continue with the baby pageant.
Exactly. And then like those 2 days, I was just like almost in despair because it's literally my job, right? So I have to get it done, and I didn't want to fail like the rest of the team. So like the 2 days were like a total nightmare, but then I was like, okay, like I slept myself a little bit and thought, okay, now the real like game is starting. And then like pitches were continuously going well. And the funny thing is that it isn't necessarily correlated to the performance in your pitch, which many founders think. Like,
right,
usually like it varies a little bit, but it's mostly about like the general like level that your company's at, and also the pitch itself. But then a lot also about, is the investor receptive to what I'm saying? Because different people have very different like perspectives, and sometimes you need to like change it within the pitch. But yeah, often like if an investor is already distracted by something else or like doesn't really like it from the beginning, then you just can't get it done. So you need to move them out of the process as quickly as possible and focus on the ones who are actually interested. And then the funny thing is, then we started talking to some people, then we got the first term sheet, and then afterwards it just exploded. Like we had the first term sheet on the table, then we got like 5 others within a day. It ended with like people like getting my WhatsApp number from like founders that they knew, and like VC partners just like sending me signed term sheets via WhatsApp and like spam calling me. So it was like a complete difference. Like the one day, like the Friday, I was in complete despair. Like the weekend, I was just like very worried. Monday, I went in, pitched again. We got the first term sheet. I just walked like 2 rooms over, tell the others, guys, we just got our first term sheet. We were super hyped. And then it like completely changed the whole dynamic, which is very interesting. And I hear that a lot from my friends who are raising as well. The first good term sheet is usually the turning point for everything.
First of all you need is one. I always tell founders this. There's a lot of companies that you see headlines about nowadays that were one term sheet away from going away. That's number one. Second thing is, despite what everybody says, investors are herd like in nature. And if they see validation from top tier investors or even any type of investor, at least that makes them feel that their money is not going into the ether. So I want to talk about what the headline was, what the end result was, and then it would be helpful to hear why you selected the partner that you chose.
Mm-hmm. I think the headline was something like, Tiger Global is betting on outcome-based financing becoming mainstream, or something like that.
Yeah.
And we raised
the total, go ahead.
$6.3 million seed round. We originally, like, our minimum target was 4.5. It like expanded over the time of the race. And the funny thing is, like, everyone thought, like, at least most people thought, well, okay, Tiger just paid the most money, but we had like two other firms who actually were paying us significantly higher valuations than Tiger did. But like we chose Tiger as the lead for three main reasons. One, the process with them was just amazing. Like, not only fast, but the cool thing was they asked the same question as everyone else did, who was like longer in the process, but they did it in 2 days instead of 4 weeks or like 3 weeks or whatever. So they were just insanely fast. First call with me, second call with me, diligence call with the team, term sheet. So they did the same work as others, but they just compressed it. So we really like that because it shows that they care about like running a good process. Secondly, we are a fintech, and Tiger Global has a lot of street cred in the traditional finance community. So like since then, we get significantly more inbound applications from like literally everyone, even tangentially related to finance. So that was the second thing. Like, it just gives us a lot of street cred. And then lastly, one thing we value is people who don't push their opinions too much on us, but who let us work and who we can pull help from if we need it. And that was the vibe we got from them. And that's also how we work to this day, because we hear about so many like nightmare stories of investors wanting to influence too much about the company. Yeah. And that's just not how we think about it. We think about, yes, smart capital. And that's also why we got you on board or some of our angels and then also some of the other seed funds. But we mostly just want to like have our environment that we work in and operate and iterate. And then when we need help, we will tell our investors. That's how we think about it.
That's awesome. And I'm glad to hear that criteria from an insider, because there's a lot of noise about Tiger and most of it's not true. I also want to acknowledge that you called me smart, and I'm going to keep that on the record.
You can make a clip out of it.
That one's going to go in the video. Well, we're nearly out of time. I always like to end on 12-month plan and 10-year plan. If you can provide me with those, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I can tell you the 12-month, 10-year, and 50-year plan.
Woo.
So let's go with that and then see if David and Costa agree. So I think the 12-month plan for us is find real PMF. That's the headline. And we have very strict criteria of what we consider a PMF. And we don't want fake PMF. We don't want PR PMF. We want the real thing that's underneath it all. And that means for us that we want to reach a point where the product that we are distributing is in so much demand that we can't keep up with it, right? And it's not breaking because of like some like buggy thing, but just because so many people want it. That's like the 12-month plan, like in a short, concise manner. The 10-year plan is to solve like a really, really big problem with the specific skills, resources, and assets we have. And the one we're currently trying to solve is access to education so that people don't have to rely on their financial background or like their family upbringing in terms of determining how successful they are. Because we literally get angry when we think about that. Because we know so many smart people who didn't have the chances of some of our also good friends who just had a very good upbringing, right? So we want to level the playing field. And that's I think, the 10-year like vision. And the 50-year vision is a bit different. So the plan that the three of us have is we want to build a great business together and solve problems together for the next decade. So this is not a like only Blair thing. We will do this for like as long as we, as Costa can type, and David and I can talk. That's basically the goal that we have.
We want to stay healthy. We want everyone in our close circle to stay healthy. We just want to build things that we can be proud of, no matter how successful they are and what time period. We want to be good co-founders. We want to be good leaders. I think that's super important for all of us. We want to be good friends to one another, and the rest will follow. I think we're all very, very bullish long-term. Mid and short-term, sometimes things like COVID hit and it's difficult, but we are very, very optimistic if we look into the next 10 or even 50 years.
Guys, it's awesome to have you on the show. It's been truly awesome to watch. Just build, and it's a hard problem you're working on. And, you know, look, to the founders that are listening, this is a group of guys who has, yes, they've made a lot of great headlines, but they've been working their tail off from the very beginning, and they never stopped scratching and clawing to get to where they are. And I know that they'll continue to do that. So thanks for being on the show, and take care.
Thanks, John. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us, John.